This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert.
Hello and welcome to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network via satellite and the Digital Delivery Network and locally on 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, on air since 1993. I'm Adam Stobbs.
And I'm Peter Forty.
And joining us today will be Professor of Politics from Monash La Trobe University.
You have to be very careful not to repeat that mistake.
La Trobe University.
Thank you.
Professor Dennis Altman.
Morality and politics have always been intertwined. At one time, it was easier to pass laws prohibiting certain types of human behaviour on the grounds of immorality. These were times when most people found it difficult to object due to the threat of imprisonment or worse. Nowadays, it seems that in some countries, minority groups are finding it easier to have a voice and to make change. Dennis Altman has for many years been an advocate for gay rights and in times when male-to-male sex was illegal. Are we seeing more bad behaviour from politicians than we used to in the past, or is it just being reported more often? And what should Kevin Rudd tell the Pope?
Indeed, what should Kevin Rudd tell the Pope? Who knows and who cares? Dennis Altman, welcome to Allegro and welcome to the Community Radio Network.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You are a professor of politics, but you're so much more than that. I've been a sort of a fan of yours for a long time, although I don't necessarily agree with everything you say. But I've listened to you on radio, I've read your books, some of them, although I've forgotten a lot of them because I was at school when I read the first one.
It's all right. Fans are not expected to agree.
Good. And but there's several things about you that I find quite interesting. As one of you, when we were lining up this interview, you said you would do the interview as long as I could guarantee that I'd read two of your books.
I have had very strange experiences of talking to people on radio. You get into the studio, the microphones are switched on, and it becomes perfectly clear they haven't the slightest idea who you are, why they're talking to you, what you might know about. So you develop a filtering system.
Okay, did you listen to any of my podcasts?
No.
Aha!
But then you invited me, right?
Okay.
This is a blind date on my part. You're the person who took the initiative. You went online and chose me. I therefore have no obligations.
A blind date.
Pretty good. That's why I've got you here. I'm up against somebody who's not going to sit there and put up with me. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let's put it into perspective a little bit. A gay activist. Are you a gay activist?
You know, I always dislike that phrase. And, of course, I recognise that's probably accurate in some ways, but I always thought of myself as a writer. And
okay.
I became a gay activist by default because when my first book, Homosexual, was published in Australia, it was originally published in the US and was then published here, I became for a short time a spokesperson for what was then a new movement. And mm-hmm. because I had published a book, I was therefore a good person to be trotted out on radio and television. And by default became an activist. But for example, I mean, I lived in Sydney through the 70s when gay activism was beginning in Australia. I always managed to avoid arrest. I'm one of the people who genuinely was at the first Mardi Gras, but I was not in the Darlinghurst police cells.
Oh, I was.
Well, there you are, Adam. We could have met there. But you see, I actually picked somebody up on the outskirts of the crowd and we went home.
God.
Oh, God. So that's how you avoided it, was it?
Right. That's well, pretty good strategy, if you ask me.
Well, you know, I could have picked someone up in the Darlinghurst cells, from what I gather.
No, it wasn't that interesting. Well, so you've been around doing all of this probably as long as I have. So we've seen quite a substantial change over the years in Australia, or have we?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely huge. You know, when I first published Homosexual, and I came out publicly with a bang because I'm a bit of an exhibitionist, and I didn't actually think through the implications of going on national television. It was very interesting. At that stage, most of the people of my generation who are now known to be gay, and I probably don't want to mention names because it could sound a bit bitchy, but they were deeply closeted.
Yes.
And I can think of some people who are now seen as great heroes
who
actually at the time...
That's
right. Now, of course, anybody can come. And there are very few areas left where people genuinely face much discrimination if they come out. I find it very interesting. We can have a member of the federal cabinet, whom everybody knows is lesbian. We can have the governor general's new official secretary is a gay man. He was previously an Australian ambassador in Europe. He and his partner were recognised by the government, and by the government they are accredited to. And of course, I guess the most symbolic example is the gay diver, who won the gold medal in Beijing and is known and was reported very widely as being there with his lover and his mother, as all good gay boys should be.
And the wonderful thing is he didn't come out because he was already out.
Exactly.
He saw no reason why he should pretend not to be gay or anything.
Yeah.
A lot of those people who didn't come out at that particular time when you came out probably did so with reasonable reason, but also many of them came out after they retired, it's particularly sporting people and singers, sort of, you know, when their career's winding down, they then come out because they're not likely to be in fear of their job. I'm sometimes critical of them because, yes, you know, they jump on the bandwagon after, like Elton John came out quite late in his career after years and years, and everybody's saying he's this fantastic gay hero. Where was he in the 80s when everybody was dying? And where were some of our other Australian people who are recognised as being gay heroes? Where were they when we were fighting for our lives?
Well, I think I'm a bit ambivalent about this. I mean, I agree with you at one point, and I must say some people have been able to come out as a very successful career move. I've always thought that the hero worship, or perhaps one should say heroine worship, of Ellen DeGeneres, who basically salvaged a crappy career by coming out, is very weird. I don't know why she's held up as a great role model. She came out at a point when that was an advantageous thing to do. As far as I know, she suffered absolutely nothing but got a huge blaze of publicity. But on the other hand, most of the people that you're talking about, I think, were around. It seems to me that in Australia, at least, the AIDS epidemic actually did lead to a number of very significant people coming out publicly. And I'm thinking of someone like Stuart Challenger, the conductor of Sydney Symphony, who then, of course, died of AIDS. Yes. So I'd be a bit cautious. I was then not sure about politicians. I think that, the question is, at what point should we demand that somebody comes out? And I think that's an interesting question. It's not always obvious.
It is a nebulous area. One of the things, of course, one must do in the coming out process, is it going to affect your livelihood? Because at the end of the day, we all of us have to work for a living, and at those times, coming out may have actually impacted on their livelihood.
Well, it's not just your livelihood, is it? I mean, if you've got a wife and family, and it makes it even more difficult.
Oh, but we're talking about sort of like people who are gay, not sort of the closeted
ones. Why?
It's quite an interesting...
Yes, I think Peter's right. Why? I mean, why are we not also talking about people who are bisexual, or whether actually bisexual or bisexual by convenience, and coming out does actually pose other sorts of questions.
Who cares?
Well, Peter and I probably care.
We care, yeah.
Well, I don't. But what I do care about is this fact. Now, here's the hypocrisy, Dennis Altman, is me standing here pontificating and saying people should come out, blah, blah, blah. I've recently, in the last few years, moved into a sphere of work where I've actually had to go back in the closet.
This is because you're teaching children music, is that right?
Something along those lines.
Yes.
But I'm working in a situation which has exemption on the anti-discrimination laws. But you know what? I'm quite happy to do it because I so love the work. And I love the place that I'm at. And the kids that I teach are just so remarkable, and so are their parents, that I just do it without question.
So if the headmaster or the principal of your school said to you, Adam, are you gay? What would you say?
He wouldn't ask me. We've had a conversation.
Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is, would you stay in the closet or would you actually admit that
you're
gay? I would
say yes. Now they've been there for some time because I'm in a situation where they probably wouldn't want me to go.
Don't you love the way people avoid an answer by saying, well, he wouldn't ask?
He wouldn't. But if there was a different principal and they asked me, I would say yes, of course.
So you'd know that there's a possibility you could be sacked.
Yes.
It's interesting. I think what you're telling us is that the school has a don't ask, don't tell policy
exactly.
based on the US military.
Exactly. They do indeed. And I've had a conversation. Now, I wanted to move this away from me because everybody wants to talk about me because I'm so interesting and they want to talk about my sex life because I'm so gorgeous. I wanted to get away from that. And you alluded...
I have to say that had not occurred to me as a temptation.
I didn't know you were blind. I wanted to move on...
I'm not going to be drawn any further.
I did warn you. Now, you alluded to something here. I wanted to talk about Penny Wong.
Mm-hmm.
Right, here's an out lesbian who's all of a sudden gone back, and you would think that an out lesbian in the Labour Party would be on our side and say she supports civil unions, same-sex partnership recognition and all of that, gay marriage even, if we want to go to that extreme. Bronwyn Pike did it here in Victoria. Tanya Plibersek, I believe, has done it. And several other politicians have done it. And here's Penny Wong not wanting to be drawn in on the question. What's all that about?
Well, I guess here my sympathies are entirely with Penny Wong. I think the reality is if you have a leading position in a political party, mm-hmm. you basically accept that there will be certain limits. And you accept those limits because you can do other things. And I think what Penny Wong is trying to do in what might be the most significant domestic portfolio in the Rudd government, seeing she's responsible for climate change and water, outweighs the emotional surge she might feel by taking a brave stand, which wouldn't actually change very much, about gay marriage. And nor, of course, should we assume she's in favour of gay marriage. I mean, I think there's a real danger of assuming that because somebody is homosexual, they therefore support everything that the current lesbian gay movement is in favour of. I have grave doubts about gay marriage, and
certainly,
if I were a member of this government, it would not be a high priority for me. The reference to Bronwyn Pike is, I think, just an example. You know, politicians have principles that are largely moulded by what they need to do to win the next election. Bronwyn
yes,
Pike...
is a 1%
exactly.
swing in this seat.
And a swing to the Greens, not a swing to the Liberals. And that's the basic point. Bronwyn Pike won't... There will be no political repercussions because the Labour Party know perfectly well, same with Tanya Plibersek, if you come from the inner city of Sydney or Melbourne, your biggest opponent is the Greens, and therefore, if you're a Labour member, you have leeway to say things that you don't have if your major opponent is on the right.
So you think it's all spin?
No, I suspect Bronwyn Pike is, as far as I know, she's a decent, sensible human being. And I suspect that, you know, if we had Penny Wong and Bronwyn Pike here and we turned off the mics and, you know, Peter and I and you, gorgeous Adam, were all sitting around with the two of them, we'd probably all come to some agreement.
Good, because we get Bronwyn Pike in here from time to time. Mm-hmm. I'll let her know what you said. Our special guest on Allegro today is Dennis Altman. We're talking various things about politics. And, of course, Dennis's insight as being the professor of politics. You don't mind me calling you Professor Altman. It just makes it sound as though I'm more credible, actually.
It also makes it sound as if I'm older, but there you are.
Now, I wanted to talk about... There's a certain degree of hypocrisy, as I see it, Professor Altman, in the Victorian State Parliament this week. We've done two fairly in-depth interviews on this show with people involved in the abortion debate. We had Lynn Allison mm-hmm. and Leslie Kenold, and we discussed in depth about the decriminalisation of abortion. And we had Neil Francis and Dr. Rodney Syme in some weeks ago talking about dying with dignity. Both of those bills came up in State Parliament this week. The decriminalisation of abortion looks as though it's happening. But yet this dying with dignity one, which seems far more compassionate and more logical to me, has been declined. What's your take on this?
Well, I think the basic difference... I mean, I think we could talk about this at two levels. One is at the level of whether or not you're right that euthanasia is more logical and more humane, and there people have different views. But I think the political difference is that the decriminalisation of abortion is purely about recognising the legal status quo, in effect. It's putting into legislation something that is in practice accepted. The euthanasia is much trickier because although clearly as I'm sure Rod Syme would have told you, there are doctors who are willing to help people in certain circumstances die faster. It is a much less clear area. I mean, I happen to be a strong supporter of the Dying with Dignity move. I'm a strong supporter of the legalisation of abortion as well. But I don't think that there's hypocrisy. I mean, I can understand that somebody could be in favour of one and not of the other, even though I'm actually in favour of both moves. And I can understand... I mean, the people who oppose both are the sort of people who, it seems to me, are terribly concerned about life when it's unborn and life when it's suffering and terminal, and have no interest in the lives of most people and the sufferings of most people between those two stages.
The reality of the situation, though, where the hypocrisy seems to be, is both abortions and the Dying with Dignity, which is not quite euthanasia. It's a little bit different to general euthanasia. It's happening anyway.
It is, but I think the difference is that the current legal status of the two is somewhat different.
Yes.
I think it's also probably unfortunate that the two measures came up at the same time, because I suspect for a lot of politicians, this posed a really difficult problem. Were they willing to take on the organised religious opposition on both issues? Now, my hunch is that some of them probably made a decision that they really weren't willing to do that. And that if, in fact, as my understanding is, the Dying with Dignity was introduced by the Greens. Is that right? In the upper house?
Look, I can't remember.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the timing is a little strange. We should also remember that, of course, the decriminalisation of abortion hasn't gone through yet.
No.
It still has to be voted on in the upper house, and it's not absolutely clear that it will go through.
There are 20,000 abortions in Victoria every year, 55 a day that works out, but they've been legal and they've been happening in Victoria since 1979, thanks to Bertram Wainer. So it's not as if this law is going to really change anything. It's just going to remove the possibility for decriminalisation. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo with Adam and Peter. Our special guest is Professor Dennis Altman here on the Community Radio Network.
Hello, this is Sarah Brightman, and I'm horrified to be on Allegro Non Troppo with awful Adam Stobbs.
Our special guest today is the convener of politics at La Trobe University, Professor Dennis Altman. Continuing our discussion with Professor Altman this morning, we wanted to have a little bit of chat about, there was a thing happening with the West Australian election. At the time of going to air, the outcome of the West Australian election hasn't been decided yet. But Dennis Altman, your take as a professor of politics, where we see the Liberals and the Nationals and the who've been bedfellows for a long time in coalition, it looks as though that might be coming to an end in West Australia.
Well, it does. The Nationals are playing it very smart. They've got, I think, four or five seats, which means they represent a very small part of the electorate, but they're the crucial four or five seats, and they are basically selling themselves to the highest bidder and offering to do deals with either Labor or Liberal. And at this stage, we actually don't know the outcome. The last I heard was Senator Barnaby Joyce sounding rather unhappy at the prospect of a Labor national coalition and warning his colleagues in WA not to contemplate going to bed with the devil.
Yes, I would say Barnaby Joyce would. That sounds very much like him. So why has this come about? Now, 20 years ago, this would have been an unthinkable situation. But does it mean that the political parties, that the ones on the right have moved a little bit more towards left-centre and the ones on the left have moved a little bit more right-centre?
You know, it isn't absolutely true that it's unthinkable. There was a period a long time ago, I mean, further back than any of us even can remember, Adam, when there was a national Labor coalition in Victoria. I think the reality is the Nationals are declining because the number of people in Australia who actually live off the land is a shrinking percentage, and the Nationals are floundering, and over the last year they've actually, you know, in different states been trying quite different options. So that in WA they've gone it alone and have got themselves in this position of the balance of power, whereas in Queensland they're actually talking of merger with the Liberals. But remember, even in Victoria, the National Party is not in a formal coalition with the Liberals, so they have left the way open. If after the next state election, we could quite possibly have the same scenario here. I think in Victoria it would be very unlikely that you'd get a national Labor coalition. But I think your other point is absolutely right. When you look at it at a state level, it is very hard to see much difference on many issues between the political parties. Basically, they're in pretty well every state of Australia a collection of mediocrities who are about managing large aspects of government services.
And their policies are all starting to sound very, very similar. There's minor differences based on small things, but things to do with the economy, things to do with the management of the states, etc., and indeed the country, they're all starting to have very similar policies, and then they accuse each other of pinching their policies.
So, well, you know, I think we would probably be very happy to settle for them collectively having a few policies.
Yeah.
So how honest are politicians, really? I mean, if they have to say what they think the electorate want to hear sooner than what they really believe...
That's good. I mean, this is a democracy. We want politicians to reflect what we think. We don't want politicians, essentially, to run things entirely on their own personal whims.
But often,
I have no problem with that.
But often when they speak it as if it's what they believe sooner than what they're... when it may not be what they believe.
Look, I think there's a great tendency in Australia to attack politicians precisely for being like the rest of us, rather than to actually say, well, politicians are us. They are the people we elect to manage various things collectively that we can't do for ourselves. And I don't think our politicians are less honourable or more dishonest or more corrupt or less intelligent. You know, I can go on with all those words.
Aren't they,
than anybody else in the community.
Dennis Altman, aren't they supposed to be objective?
I'm not quite sure what objective means.
Aren't they supposed to put their beliefs, their personal beliefs, particularly religious beliefs, behind them to act in the best interests of the community? Look at Tony Abbott and the RU486 debate where he tried to veto, not to have RU486 allowable in Australia because of his religious beliefs.
Yes, but if you have strong religious beliefs, then you will, of course, necessarily believe that is in the best interest of the country. I don't think you can accuse someone like Tony Abbott of insincerity because he follows his beliefs. You can say, as I would, that his beliefs are medieval superstitions based on essentially a sadomasochistic story of 2,000 years ago. I'm quite happy to say that. But the reality is he would be much more of a hypocrite if he ignored his beliefs.
You think so? I thought, because I would think that a politician would say, this is what I believe and this is what I personally think, but what is best for the people who I am representing? What is going to be the best thing for them? And the best thing for them, research had shown, and there was facts and figures, there was the World Health Organization report, everything, that using RU486 was going to be safer for people. Yet he chose not to do that because of his religious things.
But I think God trumps research, doesn't it?
I don't know.
I'm trying to remember how that story ended. I think it ended with a parliamentary vote and he was overruled.
Yes, he was.
Which means that one could say the outcome was actually probably the correct outcome because it was the correct outcome. We all agree on that, I think, here anyway. But it was an outcome that was reached that allowed Tony Abbott to, in fact, be sincere to his beliefs but be outvoted. Adam, I have to congratulate you. You have actually put me in a position where I'm sitting on live radio defending Tony Abbott. I think we should probably ring Tony Abbott's office and tell them because he might want to listen. If you look at Tony Abbott's record as Minister for Health, he actually often held back from imposing his religious beliefs. Now, it's interesting, if you look at him in AIDS policy, he clearly was very uncomfortable with many of the established policies in Australia about HIV prevention. And he did make life difficult, at least his bureaucrats made life difficult in some ways. It's, I think, got somewhat easier since there's been a change of government. But he didn't do what George Bush has done. He didn't try and impose unilaterally and in a draconian way a set of religious precepts over what public health officials were telling him.
Okay. Well, that says a lot for our political system and our political society here, that at times we can do that. Thank you for enlightening us a little bit on that.
And we will email Tony Abbott and tell him that he has unexpected fans in gay and lesbian radio. I think he would be sufficiently embarrassed by that.
Now, listen, we were talking about politicians before. I did want to have a bit of a chat because one of the things I love about politics is the way that we all beset politicians who behave badly. Some of them are... sometimes, you know, it's things that I have done and would do myself. But it just so happens, and most of us do silly things from time to time. Just when you're in politics, it seems to be that much worse. I have a lot of sympathy for poor John Brogdon. You know, John Brogdon used to be the leader of the
Liberals. This is the man who was constantly photographed in Speedos, coming out of the surf at Bondi and proclaiming his readiness to lead New South Wales.
I don't know about the pictures.
I think so.
He's the one that said Premier Carr's...
And then tried to kill himself.
Yes.
Yes.
He said Premier Carr's wife was a mail order bride, and he commented on the size of the breasts of some female journalists when he'd had a few drinks one night. And the story goes it was actually the journalists who were buying him the drinks, so they wanted to get him tanked up so we would say stupid stuff.
Well, I think there's a difference between what people do and what people say, and what he said in the first case was deeply offensive. I think it is perfectly legitimate to say that someone who makes those sort of comments is not an appropriate person to lead a government. So in this case, I don't think it's... I think it was right for the media to report it. On the other hand, because I don't want to be too prudish about this, I don't quite know why the minister in New South Wales had to resign after 2.5 days in his job this week.
Because, for dancing in his undies.
For dancing in his undies. I mean, I don't actually understand who suffered from that. See, in the first case, Bob Carr's wife, Helen Carr, was actually deeply offended, quite rightly. I mean, it's not a pleasant thing to be said about either of the Carrs, and they had, I think, every reason to take offence. It may well be that this particular politician was not attractive dancing in his undies, but I think all of us have been exposed to many unattractive men dancing in their undies, and we're still here.
You're talking about Matt Brown in New South Wales, yes.
And now, referring to an article you wrote in The Age, what should Kevin Rudd tell the Pope?
Yes, this went back to the Pope's visit, which was, a couple of months ago when he came out. Ironically, the oldest Pope ever, I suspect, came out for World Youth Day and didn't come out in the sense that we used that term earlier in the show. I think the main thing I thought Kevin Rudd should say to the Pope was that the Catholic Church's prohibitions on condoms are directly leading to large numbers of people being unnecessarily infected with HIV and dying. And I have no question that the single greatest hypocrisy of the Catholic Church and the single greatest evil perpetuated by the Catholic Church is its teachings around the use of condoms, given the damage this is doing to HIV prevention programs in many parts of the world. We'd be prepared to bet that Kevin Rudd did not raise the subject in the several audiences I think he had with the Pope.
There is quite a gap, though, isn't there, between the hierarchy of any church, I suppose, particularly the Catholic Church. They are so far removed from the priests and others working at the grassroots and working with the people, and they see the suffering of the people. Do you think the Pope is aware of the pain and hardship that is caused by his doctrine against using condoms, for instance?
Look, whether he is or not, in a sense, seems to me irrelevant. The problem, and you know, I know you're not doing this, but I've actually had arguments with Catholics who say, indeed, I had an argument once on an aeroplane with a Catholic priest who was one of Tony Abbott's advisors on AIDS, who used exactly that line. He said, yes, but if you go into the slums of Manila, or you go into the rural areas of Uganda, Catholic priests are in effect saying to people, it's okay to use condoms if it's to save life. The problem is the Catholic Church is a deeply authoritarian structure. I objected to the Pope being treated as a head of state. I mean, I objected to the whole state visit. I objected to our Prime Minister even meeting him. I think Kevin Rudd should have said, this man is here as representative of a religion. I respect the fact that Australians have religious freedom, the fact that many Australians are deluded and choose to believe in Christianity, and he's one of them, is fine. But I object to the legal and diplomatic fiction that makes the head of a church equivalent to a head of state.
Quite strong words from Dennis Olbermann.
Well, I was trying to trump you, Adam, you see. I thought I'd get in with the anti-clerical stuff before you did.
I frequently take that point. I'm a fairly rampant atheist. I'm a fan of Richard Dawkins very heavily. But then again, I see, when we're talking about this hypocrisy of the church, one of the ones that's really upset me lately is I read the positional statements of the Salvation Army. And they do so much wonderful work in the community. You know, and I have great respect for the work they do. And then I read their positional statements where they take selected quotes from the Bible and say, we cannot tolerate homosexuals within our organisation because of these particular statements in the Bible and out of the Old Testament. And they've taken them in the context and used them. And it's just this sort of hypocrisy I can't stand. But look, I wanted to just follow on about the bad politicians just for a sec before we do some other things. Tony Abbott is one of my favourites for his bad behaviour. Because his bad behaviour, he doesn't do it very often, but making those comments he did about poor Bernie Banton, you know, the man who died from asbestos, said that it was a media stunt and that people were dying every day. And he turned up late to a press conference luncheon, half an hour late that time. Did you see that when it was on?
Yes, I'm not sure. I think there's a distinction between the two. He turned up late because there were problems with transport, and anyone who's been stuck in traffic will understand that does happen. I don't know that that's willful bad behaviour. My memory is he then behaved fairly unpleasantly to Nicola Roxon at the lunch.
That's what I was talking about.
We can hold him responsible for. And certainly, the comments about Bernie Banton, I think it's equivalent to your question about John Brogdon's comments about the
sometimes
cars.
Sometimes you make some, you say yes.
Well, no, you shouldn't. I mean, I think it is reasonable to expect people in public life. And let's not restrict it to politicians. I mean, entertainers are the same. Anyone who uses the media to promote themselves, which politicians and entertainers and even the occasional academic and writer has been known to do, has some obligation, and I think it's reasonable to hold people to account for what they say.
Have you done any bad behaviour, Dennis Altman, that you'd like to recount on air? That we've probably got an audience, a much bigger audience than you have on 774, let me tell you.
Well, put it this way, there are probably more people listening with whom I have done bad behaviour than listen to me on 774 Drive Time.
Indeed there are. The other one that I really... There's a couple of others that I really like that I think the way that the media has made such witch hunts out of them is Troy Buswell in West Australia, the chair-sniffing incident. I don't think that was such a huge incident, but they've turned it into something enormous. And then you've got Della Bosca and Belinda Neal with the iguana stuff.
Yes. By the way, we've just got a text message in that says the Pope is a head of state, like it or not, it's a fact. And that's, of course, true. But it doesn't mean that that has to remain a fact. I think it is perfectly possible for the Australian government to say, this is a fiction. We are a secular society. We are not... I mean, the one thing Kevin Rudd did do when the Pope was here was upgraded our representation at the Vatican. I find that an unnecessary act.
Indeed. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter. Our special guest is Dennis Altman. We've seen some interesting things happening locally with politics here, particularly when we have ex-premiers coming out and making comments about gay and lesbian people. Dennis Altman, we had Jeff Kennett, drew a line connecting paedophiles with gay, lesbian, bisexual people recently.
Yes, and I think it basically went largely unnoticed. I mean, there were some stories in the gay press.
We had to buy an advertising space in The Age and put a big third of a page ad to say that we were outraged because none of the mainstream... Why didn't the mainstream media pick up on this?
I think the reality is ex-premiers are not that interesting. And, I mean, it's tempting to say that most people in the media also would not have noticed or realised the extent to which that sort of stereotype is actually a very dangerous one. And I think that, you know, the community organisations were right in this case. I think sometimes when those sorts of things are said, the best solution is to do nothing, because the problem is, of course, if you respond, you're giving more airtime to the allegations to the people who make them. In this case, I think it was absolutely right to respond, because that is such a widely spread and inaccurate stereotype. In a way, it gave people an opportunity to yet again point out that most paedophilia is actually not homosexual.
But the thing is, if he'd said it, say, about blacks or Jews or something, the media would have been onto that probably and really made an issue of it. But because it's about gay people and paedophilia, they didn't.
Look, I'm not at all convinced of that. I mean, the most outrageous things are said constantly in Australia about people who are Muslim, about people of Middle Eastern origin, about people who are Arabic, about Indian taxi drivers. I don't notice a great deal of indignation coming forward. I think the reality is that unless community organisations themselves do what in this case was done, the media tends to pass over them. Or you get, you know, you're lucky. You get a journalist in the right spot at the right time who says, here's a story. I don't think there's a conspiracy about it. I think the reality is a lot of it people don't pay much attention to.
Our special guest today on Allegro Non Troppo is Professor Dennis Altman. Professor Altman, I wanted to ask you a little bit about a comment you made on local radio stations some time ago, which particularly struck me as being very poignant and observant. And it was observant to the fact that, yes, it's exactly the case, but I hadn't heard it articulated, and you're right. Whereas you said that the fact that the current government and political bodies around the country are more accepting of gay and lesbian stuff is not a political evolution, but more of a generational change.
Yes, and I think this was in reference, I think it came up as we were talking about the fact that the Rudd government have basically undertaken to do a whole review of all sorts of federal legislation that's discriminatory. And I think I was reflecting on Howard, who still basically has many of the attitudes that go back to his generation. And between Howard and Rudd, there's a clear generational shift. I think, you know, there's also the question of familiarity. And the reality is that politicians on either side who've had a lot to do with the gay community tend then to take up issues of discrimination much more willingly. I mean, oddly enough, one of our strongest supporters was the Liberal member for Herbert up in Queensland, which is around the seat of Townsville. Not someone I think anybody would have predicted, but presumably because of either a family or friendship connection.
Warren Inch.
Yes, and I may be wrong, actually. He may have been the member for Leichhardt, which is Cairns.
One of those northern.
But certainly somewhere in North Queensland. But you expect politicians from the areas where there's an organised lesbian gay community, which means from the inner cities, who are almost always going to be Labor members, are going to be more aware of the issues, partly because they have to be for electoral reasons.
Well, one of our local Melbourne metropolitan members who quite surprised me in coming out was Petro, and supporting it was Petro Georgia. But he's small L liberal.
I think Petro's a small L liberal, and you know, it is not inconsistent. There are a lot of small L liberals who've taken very good positions. Remember that the history of decriminalisation of homosexuality in Australia goes back to a motion in the federal parliament that was a joint motion by John Gorton, a liberal, and Moss Cass, a Labor member. Mm. Now, if somebody's listening and I've got it wrong, they will undoubtedly, despite your warning, text us in. But I think that's right.
Our special guest, Dennis Altman, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the future. Do us a bit of a prediction here. I think that gay marriage or relationship recognition, while it's not an important for the three of us in here in this studio at this time, it's probably not an important issue because it's never been an option for us, perhaps.
But hang on. Recognition relationship, I think, is very important. And I think, by and large, we've got it. I mean, we're speaking in Melbourne under Victorian legislation. There's already a certain amount of partner recognition. Certainly, I know when I was in hospital a couple of years ago, my partner was treated exactly the same as he would have been had he been my spouse. I know that I've been conscious of it is around the rules governing superannuation. And interestingly, Adam, after I made that comment you referred to, it was in conversation with Lindy Burns on ABC Radio in Melbourne, I was fascinating. I got an email from someone who works for the NTUU, University Super Organisation, assuring me that they respected my right to name my partner as my dependent for super purposes. So I think a lot of that is already there, and I think that's important. I mean, I think inevitably some form of civil union is going to become recognised across at least the Western world within the next 10 years. I absolutely agree with you.
Yes, it's one of these evolutions. What about transgendered issues? That's another thing that seems to be somewhat of a difficult political thing happening. Can you see any change happening there?
Again, I think there will be legal changes. Some of them raise complications for a lot of people. I think the difference is that the great majority of us, and I'd include myself, remain somewhat mystified by transgender. And I say mystified not in a hostile way. I think lots and lots of people are deeply sympathetic to the fact that somebody goes through torment growing up believing that their gender has been wrongly assigned. But for most of it's a bit of a puzzle. Whereas for most people, it is not that difficult to imagine being attracted sexually to someone of the same gender. Mm. Homosexuality in that sense is, it really isn't a big deal. We live in a society that's made a big deal of it. And we've all grown up, of course, making a big deal of it for obvious reasons. But it's something that's very much part of the human experience. I'm not sure that for most people the sense that your gender is so wrong that it should be surgically reassigned, which is ultimately, transgender people often want, is that easily grasped?
Yes, that's part of, I think you've hit the nail right on the head, is the fact that it's something none of us can, a lot of us can't specifically identify with, that therein lies the anathema. Our special guest on Allegro today has been Professor Dennis Altman. If you would like more information and find out about Professor Altman, he's got quite a web presence. He's written a lot of books, some of which I've read. Coming out in the 70s was in 1979, The Homosexualization of the Homosexualization of America and the Americanization of the Homosexual. Now, I haven't read that, Dennis Altman.
Adam, your life is all the poorer for that, isn't it? Oh, come on.
You should
25 years ago.
Take out homosexualization and put in the world.
Well, I did write a book much more recently, as I tried to explain to you before, called Global Sex. So I have done that.
Okay. And there was the 51st state. I mean, I think...
Question mark.
Yes. There's going to be a lot more than that. I think when you look at countries that I've visited, they're becoming so Americanized. It's amazing.
This is part of what both Global Sex and 51st State are about.
And the reason why, I haven't read the book, but let me guess, I reckon it's because of popular culture and politics and money. Everybody wants to be American. Oh, they used to, they don't now. They do, they used to, they don't, not so much now.
Well, I think everybody wants what they perceive America to be, but they don't want to be America.
They want to have what they've got.
Yes. And increasingly, of course, as other parts of the world have it. I mean, in many parts of the world, I suspect everybody wants to live in Beijing after the images we saw during the Olympics.
Well, it's quite interesting because the images we saw in the Olympics, I thought, my God, Beijing is looking so much like Los Angeles in more places when you look inside the supermarkets and everything. So China's not being China anymore. It's starting to look a lot like Los Angeles.
Well, you could reverse it. I mean, if you go to Los Angeles, many parts of Los Angeles are much more dilapidated and poverty-stricken than are many parts of cities in what we would call the developing world.
Yeah, down in Imperial, in the southern part, yes.
I would rather go through any airport in the world, except perhaps New Delhi at midnight, than go through Los Angeles International.
Yes.
Which is a masterpiece of bureaucratic bungling, petty officialdom, and just overrun and inadequate infrastructure.
Indeed. Professor Dennis Altman, thank you so much for giving up your time to come here on Allegro Non Troppo. It's been great to catch up with you. And as I said, I've been one of your fans up to a point for a number of years, and it's just great to be able to have you on the Community Radio Network.
Thank you, Adam. And I noticed Peter very carefully has refrained from saying he's ever been a fan of mine, but it was good to meet you too.
Well,
didn't know who you were.
I knew the name.
Thank you, and hopefully we can do you again at some stage.
That sounds sufficiently ambiguous to be tempting.
Good day. We'll be back next week. We've got a very special show for you next week. We're going to be talking to victims of sexual abuse on Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Allegro Non Troppo.